Thank you very much.
Welcome. Mainland Minerals. So good morning and welcome. Thanks for putting in the original submission and the brief evidence that you also pre-circulated. We've read that, but I see you tabled something today. You happy to take us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I'm Murray Coburn from Mainland Minerals Southern. Just a quick bit of background. The company was founded in 1938 by an animal nutritionist, Fergus Hickey. He was a pioneer in use of trace minerals in New Zealand agriculture. We've got a history of innovation that continues to this day throughout New Zealand. Our company, Mainland Minerals Southern, is the largest fine particle fertiliser supplier into Southland and Otago, and the third largest fertiliser supplier overall. We also supply granular and liquid nitrogen fertiliser. We are a family-owned Southland business based in Gawler. We're focused on sustainable, smarter fertiliser solutions for local farmers. We target both the animal and the plant production through looking at the full range of major nutrients and trace minerals that are limiting factors in the soil. We're backed by science through Eurofins laboratories with their testing, Dr. Tim Jenkins, a soil scientist, Dave McKee, who's Master of Soil Science, with Soil Tech, Greg Smith, Master of Soil Science, animal nutritionist. Master of Science, animal nutritionist. We're also busy with ongoing trials with the Otago University Department of Microbiology with Dr. Sergio Morales. The points I wanted to just raise, or just back up with the key points with what we put into our submission, was with that Rule 14, the discharge of fertiliser. Fertiliser, when you see it coming out the back of trucks, dry fertiliser and big clouds of dust, it's simply not landing where it's assumed. A large part of the assumption is completely ignored that the finer dusty material has been blown by wind into waterways. GPS proof replacement technology tools are excellent, but they're largely pointless if the assumption that all fertiliser is landing within the assumed application swath width is simply not correct. All non-fluidised fertiliser with fines and or a dust component would be regarded as a non-complying activity as we see it, unless those fertiliser are direct drilled into the soils. We use fine particle fertiliser where we grind down the fertiliser to a powder consistency and mix it in a slurry form using small percentage of water, and that water is used as a carrier to land the nutrient to targeted plants within the swath width of our application techniques through plane, truck and helicopter. We look to increase the biological activity, which is within the pastures, soils, by using lime flour and microbial inoculants. This allows more locked up nitrogen, phosphorus and sulfur within the soil organic matter to be released. Often when we're applying fertiliser, conventionally a lot of the total nutrients that are locked up in the soil are ignored. It's important to look at the biological status of the soil, not just the chemical status. We also coat urea with humate. It's a very effective way to increase the efficiency of nitrogen and make sure that nitrogen is reaching the targeted plants. You can increase, there's some good trials by Southern Humates that have been done with Ag Research. You can increase the efficiency of nitrogen getting to the plant by up to 2 times. What that means is you can get up to 2 times the amount of dry matter growing for every kg of nitrogen that's supplied. So using those simple tools is a good way to help out and get less nitrogen flowing through to the water table. We also use non-water soluble phosphorus and sulphur fertiliser products. It's a simple option. available to farmers to limit pea loss into waterways. We use a fertiliser form called dicalcium phosphate. It's 16 to 18% pea, so the pH in the range of 6 to 8, typically around 90% citric soluble. Sorry, this is a bit technical, but what that means is 90% of the phosphorus is available within 1 to 4 weeks. As opposed if you're, when you're using things like RPRs, there's only 30% of the product that's available in that first one within the first 12 months. And then you've got a trailer of phosphorus that you've got to wait for. And then if you compare that to say your single superphosphates, you've got 87% of that pea is water soluble. So that water soluble pea can flow over land, or it can flow, if you've got low phosphate retention soils, it can flow through the soil into the waterways. Also the cadmium and fluoride stripped out of it, so during manufacture, so it's a better long term product in terms of heavy metal buildups in soils. Cadmium is a carcinogen as it builds up. Waikato's got a big issue with it. Southland's heading for the same issues if cadmium issues are not tackled astutely. And the Waikato, as I understand it, with the 50% of the dairy farms up there cannot be subdivided because the cadmium level's too high. So that's pretty scary. Gets into the food, up into the vegetable, and into our systems, into our livers, carcinogenic. So we strip that out of it at processing. It's got very small traces of it, but very, very low in comparison to our typical superphosphates that are used. We do add some water soluble pea, typically about a third compared to the non-water soluble pea, so that just to get some quick available phosphorus up front. But it's something I was just reading with Bert Quinn, he's founder of Summit Quinfos. Summit Quinfos was sold and swallowed up by Balance. Bert Quinn, he's still in the fertiliser industry, and he's a big advocate of using non-water soluble phosphorus products, such as the RPR and guano and the dicalcium phosphate. His view was that it was a very good way to limit the amount of phosphorus getting into waterways. Also using non-water soluble elemental sulfur products. It's with phosphorus and sulfur, when it's non-water soluble, it remains unbound. The nutrient remains unbound in the soil until the plants or the microbes need it. It eliminates the risk of wash through, where the phosphorus and sulfur can wash through the soil profile, particularly on low phosphate retention soils, such as with those water soluble products such as super and DAP type products. And then with the non-water soluble products to limit the overland flow of peat. As a company, for years we've battled with getting lumped into a liquid fertiliser basket as we use water to carry our fertiliser to the plant and to the soil. The thing that's largely overlooked though is that, and that farmers and councils need to wake up to, is that granular fertiliser, although the term solid fertiliser, much of the nitrogen and phosphorus products within those are largely water soluble. So that when they get wet, they turn into liquid nutrients, and then they're prone to leaching depending on the soil type. I've been over that. So next thing is Appendix N, the management plan requirements, point four with nutrient budgets. Just backing up what I said in the submission, but just to clarify the cation exchange capacity, our view is that cation exchange capacity and anion storage capacity are two measures in the soil that could be used very, very effectively to understand the amounts of nutrient that could be applied to soil. The reason for that, cation exchange capacity could be used, and in the United States they do use this at places, to determine how much nitrogen is applied. It's cation exchange capacity is a measure of the soil's ability to store the positively charged nutrients or cations, such as calcium, magnesium, potassium, and ammonium. When you're looking at the ammonium, the storage of nitrogen in the soil, that ammonium bound to the soil is in that Kaitaia Exchange, the Kaitaia Exchange test allows you to understand how much ammonium or nitrogen could be applied and could be held in the soil without leaching through. So it's quite an effective tool to link back to what levels of nitrogen could be applied. And then at different times of the year, how much, obviously with water, soil moisture, temperature and soil moisture is another factor that needs to be put into the equation as well. But our view is if you could look at a lot of the farms that don't have a lot of inputs and outputs, i.e. Your typical sheep and beef farm, why couldn't we have something that would be an extensive farm that would not require the overseer model to be used? One of the things that concerns me is with Warwick South, looking at the land environment plans at the moment, my understanding is that the land sustainability officers are about 10% of their way through getting the land environment plans done. So it's taken them a heck of a long time to get through. How are the fertiliser companies or the land sustainability officers going to get through these overseer models? I don't get that. I simply don't think we've got the resources to do it. So a company like ours doesn't have the resources to upskill. We can upskill, but we don't have the resources to sit in offices and do overseer plans for all farms. They're very intricate. If there was a way to have the intensive farms put through overseer models, or intensive areas of farms put through overseer models, that would take where you've got big, large outputs or large inputs of nutrient, that would limit the amount of work that would need to be done, and it would limit the cost of the farmer. So using the CEC and the anion storage capacity would be two measures that could be used for phosphorus for anion storage capacity and CEC for nitrogen application. The South and Tobacomet soil data that's on the Environment South website has currently got the typical ASC values or the phosphate retention values. They could be used, the midpoint of those could be used for each soil type. And they could be linked back to the amounts of nutrient that could be applied for extensive farms. They've also got a CEC, but that could easily be updated. The CEC could easily be updated through there, so the farmers could see the CEC and the ASC on the database in Warren Southam, and then they could link that to what maximum amounts of nutrient could be applied. Environment Southam could then look at a catchment-wide water quality measurements, and they could understand annually across the catchment are the phosphate or nitrate levels coming down, or are they okay? And therefore they could refine those levels annually if necessary based on the water quality outcomes using this extensive model. I think I've gone over most of the rest of that, so extensive zones. The one other thing that I'd like to say is that I think the overseer model should be applied using an independent organisation, such as Assure Quality. I doubt the Environment South will have the resources to do it. I'm very concerned that knowing the level of detail and the levers that can be pulled within overseer, that overseer could be used cynically with a fertiliser company applying the overseer model for clients. There's room for people to alter levels to suit their own cause as a company selling the product. So I think that should be taken on board, and that needs to be seriously considered. That's all I have.
Okay. Mr. Coburn, I think our job is to look at the plan as notified and the actual wording that's in the provisions, the policies and the rules, and then to consider if and how that exact wording should be amended in response to submissions. So just 2 points. You haven't actually indicated to us any suggested wording changes for Rule 14, so don't answer that now, but that's one issue that I think you need to explain to us if and how would you like that rule to actually be amended. And secondly, in terms of Appendix N and your suggestions there, that's not the basis upon which the plan was notified. The way that you suggest the region could be split up into extensive and intensive farming zones. So without denigrating from what you're saying, we simply couldn't grant that relief. That would require a plan change. I imagine there'd be a whole lot of people in the region would be interested in that kind of approach and would wish to submit on it. So in terms of procedural fairness and those sorts of things, we simply can't do what you're asking for at this stage. So we won't take that matter any further, your comments on Appendix N. But in terms of your concerns about Rule 14, do you have any suggestions for us about how that rule might be reworded?
I could go and have a look at that, but probably writing right now to define that might be a bit tricky.
All right. Now, you're very welcome if you're prepared to take the time later to have a look at that, and if you do have any suggestions, they could be forwarded through to one of our two assistants sitting on the other side there. Give you their email address.
Yep.
Okay, apart from that, I'll see if we have any questions for you, Lloyd.
No, I'm quite happy with where we are. Thank you.
No questions.
And Morris?
No, I don't have any. Certainly, the ideas that you promote regarding Appendix N are interesting, but as the chairman says, it's quite a long way from what was advertised. So. But we would be interested to see what you could think about the other rule, and if you've got time to do that, I think others have been asked to provide it within a couple of weeks.
Yes, and by the end of next week, on the Rule 14, that would be good.
Yep.
Okay, thanks very much for coming in.